disaster. Don't you give up, don't you let win. Talking about a forever after. Don't you give up, don't you dare give up.
Yes, it's all very precarious, but we don't give up here at Tuckner, Sipser, Weinstock & Sipser, the women's rights in the workplace advocates. This is Jack Tuckner. Thrilled to be here with you this evening with Deborah O'Rell.
Hello.
How are you?
Fantastic. And you?
Oh, I'm great, but I'll get better. Thank you very much. Well, I just want to say in advance, we'll be talking today about issues related to Women's History Month. And I just want to say up front, Tom Hartman, Katie Grant, a terrific young journalist from England, and New York Times' Nicholas Kristof have provided us with certain bullet points that we'll be talking about today. So I want to just get that out of the way. So if anyone is listening, our many thousands of listeners, I know it's difficult to call in probably at this time, but if you wish to, the call-in number is 888-874-4888. Again, 888-874-4888, and we'll take your calls, your questions, your comments. So this month, ladies and gentlemen, is Women's History Month. And this past Saturday was International Women's Day. It's a day that was originally created to celebrate women's economic, political, and social achievements. And since the very first International Women's Day was celebrated in 1910, that's how many years ago is that, Deb? It was a long time ago. It's over 100 years ago, am I right?
Exactly.
Women have made, of course, tremendous strides when it comes to political, economic, and social power. But apparently having a Women's Day annoys some people. I actually was speaking today, Deb, to a male colleague in our suite, and I told him about the show that we were doing on International Women's Day, and he only half-jokingly said, hey, what about International Men's Day? Now,
well, they say the same thing about Bring Your Daughter to Work Day.
Bring Your Children to Work Day.
Now it's evolved to, but it actually started as Bring Your Daughter to Work.
But there was a reason for that.
Exactly.
And, you know,
you're going to explain that reason.
Exactly. Now, first of all, there are people, and this is one the gentleman that I was speaking with, this was a lawyer, also has a hard time, can't figure out Black History Month either, truly doesn't understand why we don't have an entire month devoted to celebrating white history, just to be fair. But we won't bother delving into that or his psychological issues. But maybe International Men's Day isn't marked on the calendar because every day of every year is already Men's Day. So, you know, there seems to be a common misconception that we run into all the time in our work as women's rights advocates is that the battles that women have been fighting for centuries now, but let's just say the last few decades, have already been won. Yes, we do know women now have the right to vote. Oh, yeah. Can we get a little pause for that? Yes. Women have the right to vote and to work outside the home. And women also have the right now to own property. And in most parts of the world, we should be grateful, I suppose, that women are mostly no longer property themselves. But, you know, what else is left then to do? What else do these over-entitled, this half of the human population still want if they've got the right to vote and the ability to work outside the home and to drive a motor vehicle? And remember, all this just happened in very recent history. Well, from our perspective, while women have made great strides, but across the globe and in the United States, there's a whole lot that still needs to be done. We don't think that, you know, we should keep the bar as low as those of us who think that women already have enough empowerment, that this is enough. And I think that we should delve into a little today, in honor of International Women's Day, what other work needs to be done to empower ourselves, women. Again, if it's not me talking as a woman, Deborah, you talk as a female, but we could all talk, presumably, for women who we love in our lives. I think all of us have a woman that we would not like to see drawing the short end of the stick, economically, physically, on every plane. Our friend and our webmaster, who is a progressive journalist and all-around smarty pants, Sashwat Botaniak, reminds us today that International Women's Day is a commemoration that just shouldn't serve as another excuse for cosmetic sales at Bloomingdale's and Macy's. I mean, despite the lack of global initiatives to bring women's rights struggles to the political forefront, which we haven't had in some time, none of us are really paying attention to that as a global concern, the principles guiding International Women's Day remain as relevant to us as ever, given the nature of our declining profitocracy over the last 30-some-odd years since Ronald Reagan began his corporate counter-revolution. Historically, International Women's Day was an anti-war, pro-working class, pro-labor, global movement that aims to emancipate all women and men from what? From the fascist yoke of inequality that's strangling and destroying our jobs here in the United States, our manufacturing base, our security, ultimately our country, and finally our planet.
Well, it's true. The impetus, because this was much bigger, and I forget what else Sashwat had written in that blog, but the impetus for International Day actually happened in the United States, but it took off huge in Europe.
Right.
And it was right after the women went on strike in the garment district in 1908 or 1907, mm-hmm. 8 or 9 or something like that. And the women were on strike for a really long time, and that's when a number of other progressive women's organizations came to the forefront to support the women in striking with help, with money, with assistance, things like that. And then while that strike was happening, the Triangle Shirt Factory fire mm-hmm. happened mm-hmm. in, what was that, 11 or 14?
Around that time.
You know, a few years after that.
Right.
But it was really in Europe
right.
that recognition, that the need for that recognition happened there.
Right.
We hear, you know, it's a day to have car sales and, as you say, makeup sales.
But what I think also into what your point, what Sashwat was also talking about, is its genesis is that, you know, and which was largely not in the United States, but it was here back in around the same time in the early, I don't remember the year, unfortunately, in the early 20th century in the Berkeley Feminist Club. I don't recall their name either, but, you know, had a significant demonstration and presence with regard to International Women's Day, but this was in 1970, I'm sorry, wasn't with respect to the Vietnam War. And the idea that it's not just about celebrating girlhood in some sort of, you know, vacuous or superficial way.
Mm.
It's that women's issues are our issues. It's sort of, you know, labor issues and the general welfare. And if their woman is suffering in Vietnam, if women are chattels still somewhere else, then we
right.
are all suffering from that, and it brings us all down.
Exactly. Because how you do one thing is how you do everything. So if you can Well, I think somebody really important said that. And that be the point, that how you treat, and who else? Was it Gandhi or some president?
Subi Sales, we're not sure.
Well, yeah, Subi Sales. Some Roosevelt maybe said how you treat the least
among us. Right.
Was it Lincoln? It somebody important said this, but you know what the quote
well,
I'm trying
I think
to say?
That, yes, how we treat the least among us is a measure of our society's sort of evolution in cultural and consciousness
yeah.
development. So,
speaks to us, to our integrity, to our values,
yes.
to what's really important.
Yes, and of course we and how we treat the least among us. Our homeless, vulnerable, our prisoners huh. is probably again at the back of the line
mm-hmm.
in terms of all developed nations, certainly, and some
you know,
less developed nations.
Sorry, you know, you just said homeless. You know, I moved to New York in 1977.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. And when I in 1977, if there was a homeless person on the street, there could be somebody, you know, clearly a homeless person, barefoot, dirty, but sitting up against the building,
mm-hmm.
you called the ambulance. I mean, that's what
mm-hmm.
we did.
Mm-hmm.
And an ambulance would come and tend to this person. How quickly
mm-hmm.
that went away to now we just walk past them.
Right.
And it does scar my soul just ever so slightly every time.
Well, that's because we can't call the ambulance for 50,000 homeless people
every day.
So the numbers are just too difficult to contend with. So I think one of the good places to start with a discussion would be on to celebrate and to commemorate International Women's Day and Women's History Month would be to talk about women to be able to walk down the street at night without being shouted at, followed, grabbed, slut-shamed, or worse. I mean, this is just an ongoing issue everywhere and right here in the United States. More than a third of all women worldwide, 35.6% of women worldwide, will experience physical or sexual violence in their lifetime, according to the World Health Organization. I mean, again, these are just all of these statistics are just sort of mind-boggling because, again, that's one out of three.
Mm-hmm.
Right? One out of three of us.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are staggering. Last year, the Office for National Statistics, now this was in London, it doesn't matter, wherever you look. So this revealed last year that 85,000 women are raped on average in England and Wales every year, and over 400,000 women are sexually assaulted each year. This is in England alone. And many more cases,
most
never reported.
Don't get reported,
right.
Exactly.
So this isn't somebody else's problem. It's our problem. It's all of our problems. So we need International Women's Day to remind us that hundreds of millions of boys and girls are growing up in a world where violence against women is acceptable, where female subjugation is still the norm. Women perform 66% of the world's work and produce 50% of its food, but earn only 10% of its income and own only 1% of its property.
Say that again?
Hello, yeah, let me give you that again. Women perform 66% of the world's work, produce 50% of the world's food, but earn only 10% of its income and own only 1% of its property.
Staggering.
Right? So in the U.S. and the U.K. and throughout, again, most of the developed world, women, but let's just talk about the United States, are paid significantly less than men. They are absent significantly in numbers from, certain spheres like business and politics in droves. And, the fact that Rush Ladies First Limbaugh likes to open doors for women, and that shows he's, a feminist and likes women, doesn't make up for the fact that the ladies earn, on average, significantly less than their male counterparts performing the same work, still, in the United States. How about we let women open their own doors, but let them earn what they're worth? How about that?
Let's get an applause for that.
How about that? Here we go. A rousing applause for that. Okay. Deb?
Well, and I don't know if you're touching on this, but that reminds me. So women are paid less. Some statistics I read recently about, and I should have brought it with me, so I'm just going to wing it. But it had to do with, there was a study done that factored in, there were two studies I wanted to share. One is women coming out of college.
Right.
And the fact that women make less money, come out of school, and I'm making up these numbers,
right,
but it's like you come out of school, you each, men and women, both have $20,000 worth of debt, and I think 20 was about the average. Women, when you factor in the same kind of job and all of the variables, women are making $40,000, men are making $50,000. So when you are making, when you begin paying back those student loans and the average payment is about $300, that is a bigger percentage,
right,
of women's money.
Right.
So again, they have less money to invest, to take care of themselves, to buy what they need to buy, and men are making more. And this all stems from this, family wage, men have to make more.
Yeah, nonsense.
Crap.
It's just a myth.
Yeah.
And, of course, what you also, when you're talking about, they come out of college and there's already a differential, that grows, that diverges that line as men continue to make more in their chosen careers than women in similar jobs.
Exactly.
Typically.
Exactly.
So it might really be nice if we can make sure that our daughters, our wives, our sisters are earning as much as the guy who sits next to them, seems to me.
Well, and that's what brought up this other, and I wish I could remember, I think it was University Women, Association of American University Women,
mm-hmm,
I think it was them, but it could be somebody else. they did a whole study that really, because the critics mm-hmm. of there is no gender pay disparity
right.
will say it's the choices that women make. It's the choice of careers they go into. They go into teaching, nursing, you know, those kind of part-time, lower admin type of jobs or careers, social work, things like that.
Okay.
That generally pay less.
Well, why do they pay less?
Okay, well, either way, let's just say they pay less.
Right.
So they did a study that took out, so the critics say, well, women just have to make different choices. And if they made different choices, they'd make more money. And this study took out they eliminated all those choice factors, and they compared social worker to social worker, you know, this to this, and they took out all of it. And there was still a 7% difference when you factor out that choice. And the critic in this particular article I was reading, and, well, it's just 7%. And this woman, Charlotte, I think her name was Charlotte Hill, so I'll figure it out. But she said, 7%? Like, why would you scoff at 7%? That is clearly some kind of unconscious discrimination toward women, that they're just paid less.
It's also going to add up to be tens of thousands of dollars.
Well,
more
of course,
over a career, right?
Yeah, and you've seen those statistics that it's.
Well, also when you talk about, and these knuckleheads talk about these choices, you know, it's like also, you know, the choice to not to be unemployed, the choice to live under a bridge, the choice to be homeless. I mean, it's all just
the
nonsense.
Choice to discriminate.
The choice to discriminate, but also, you know, back to the jobs that, you know, you were saying that are lower wage jobs, like these sort of pink collar jobs that they've got. Why is a teacher considered less important than a hedge fund manager? So, you know, you'll hear a conservative talk about, well, the wealthy, you know, they're more productive. So why are we, you know, ranting against this productivity? Well, explain to me
how.
Is a hedge fund manager, does it produce more? Does he add more to the productive economy than a teacher? Well, I mean, the answer, of course, is no. They're actually simply skimming and detracting from our productive economy. And, you know, note that of the 42, the statistics are from 2010, there were 42 hedge fund managers, mostly in New York, that earned is the wrong word, pulled down $2 billion, that's with a B, $2 billion a year each. 42,
each.
$2 billion a year each, which comes to, by the way, anybody know the answer to how much that is per hour? $2 billion a year, 42 of them. Again, how did they earn this money? All they were doing was, it's all, you know, smoke and mirrors, and it's really coming out of, it's a zero net game, that it's coming from somewhere else. It's coming, and again, they're not producing anything to our GDP. $2 billion a year is roughly $960,000 an hour. $960,000 an hour.
$960,000 an hour. That's almost $1 million an hour.
Exactly. That's how none of us really understand what a billion is. And none of those 42 hedge fund managers, of course, were girls. Not one was a woman. Not one.
Of course.
So if a teacher is making $50,000 a year and she's molding minds, and they're our kids, we don't think it's important enough. Well, it's just a girl job. She doesn't need to really make a living wage because her husband's probably a hedge fund manager.
Well, and to productivity, American workers have never been more productive than they are in this last decade.
Exactly. Well, over.
And productivity has,
right.
When you look at the graph, it goes
right.
straight up, but income is
way down.
Yeah.
For most of us, except for the top
right.
0.1%. So, ladies, if you're listening out there, marry a hedge fund manager. That's what you have to do. It's not about, you're not going to get that job, but marry a hedge fund manager. You know, you'll be completely hooked up. So, you know, International Women's Day. You know, what is, when we stand up for women's rights, the feminist movement. You know, my whole career, I've been told that it's feminism is about, you know, excluding men, or it's about hating men. It's, you know, it's not about hating or excluding men. You know what it's about? It's about loving and valuing women. How's that? It's simple. It's like, that's what feminism is about, loving and valuing women. How about that?
I like it.
Women's rights is not just a women's issue. You know, it's very much a men's issue. So the burden for change that we often place on women. It's like, what's your problem? It's not our problem. I don't have to deal with that. Nobody's going to. I have male privilege. You deal with it. Plus, you're having, most men, I think, feel that if women have that issue to deal with and I have male privilege, I'm not going to say anything about my male privilege. You know, it's my male privilege. If you had female privilege, I'd probably detract from my male privilege. So we seem to think.
Just to compound that whole, you know, women's problem, mm-hmm. women's issue, you compound it when you become a woman of color.
Right, exactly. Well, no,
because now you're getting wham bam all over
exactly.
the place.
You get no,
it coming
thank you, ma'am.
Yeah,
right.
you get it coming from every
right.
direction.
And again, women of color were making 65 cents on a white male's
yeah.
dollar.
And Hispanic even less.
Yeah, I know, a real travesty. So it seems to me we men need to stand up and fight for our sisters, mothers, wives, lovers, friends. Now, come on, guys. It's like, challenge current definitions of masculinity. How about standing up for the women you supposedly love? So the point of International Women's Day is to celebrate women. Hello. Again, you know what we're talking about? Women. We're not talking about some exotic species of gypsy moth. This is the stuff that always boggles my mind. It's like our women. It's like us, our mothers, you know.
Right.
And for some reason, men wouldn't put up with this for 2 seconds. Clearly, it'd be, you know, we'd be rioting in the street. It wouldn't even, it's not even an issue. But we seem to accept that. And the reason that we're still celebrating, and I think we need to celebrate, you know, Women's Day or Women's History Month.
Is it really celebrate?
I think it is celebrate. I think we celebrate it. Yes, we celebrate women. We celebrate the achievements, and we talk about it because gender inequality still persists. So,
well, it does, but I don't feel like celebrating it. It's more of a awareness. It's the point of it is to
right.
have a discussion about it and to say, did you know? What am I celebrating that I make 82 cents?
Well, I know what we're not celebrating the inequality and celebrating the subjugation. What we're sort of celebrating or trying to talk about and get back to is celebrating like the feminine principle. You know, it's sort of when it comes back that the divine
it
feminine.
It feels more to me like an opportunity to demand attention to this critical issue. It's more of a not a protest. What's another word for protest? Or, I don't know, put up a poster kind of a day, like.
Well, I mean, I don't know that they're mutually exclusive, and I think that that's really what we're doing here, talking about it, is raising awareness and raising awareness to an injustice. If that's the point, if we
that's
don't
it.
Personalize it.
Raising awareness
but like,
to an injustice.
But it's what it's all about when people post on Facebook the pictures of, you know, factory farming and what happens to that, without being strident about it or calling people names, it's awareness. You know what you're eating. You know what they do. This whole animal lived its whole. It's awareness. So people aren't really aware. Are people aware, you know, of the plight? Are people aware of the, I think, 2 million genital mutilations that still go on on the continent of Africa? I mean, every year.
Yeah.
You know, sex, selective abortions, you know, the things that, the fact that just came up today in a conversation, believe it or not, that women under, you know, certain, under Quranic law in certain places, if they are raped and they're married, they could be gang raped unless one of those men will testify that it was a rape, not consensual, she's getting stoned to death. I mean, this is in part sort of the world we live in. That's an extreme example. But we have enough of our own examples here in terms of, you know, we have one major political party that is basically fighting to go back to, you know, to take us back 100 years into sort of a Victorian mode of when women really are, you know, home, barefoot, pregnant, and have, you know, do not have the ability to control their own bodies. We have in Texas now, I believe, 2 abortion centers in the entire giant state left.
I
and
know.
A lot of poor women. It's, you know, we're going to be back to back alley abortions.
Right.
They will continue to happen. And the fact that we think it's okay to say it's only for the, when it happens to the Republican congressman that can afford to fly his kid to New York, you know, for an abortion when it was not right, because it's not right for, this is not right for my girl to have this baby now, then it's okay. So I thought that what we're, you know,
I understand celebrating women,
and
but
again,
the day
we're not there yet. Well, we can celebrate women. We're certainly not there yet. When the feminine principle is actually revered again, as it once was, and we can celebrate feminine spirit.
Yes.
Okay. Of allowing, you know, and will we become more conscious as human beings, as we discussed before we were on the air, that, you know, when women are legislators, they tend to be more humane in the things that they tend to care about the least among us. They tend to care about the social safety net, and they tend to care about the common weal and general welfare and the environment. And they understand that what actually raises all ships is when everyone is not living in a necessitous way, when you don't have one in four children that have food insecurity, meaning they're freaking starving and they go to sleep hungry. And just good economics, as Krugman always says, fairness is good economics.
Right.
And women's empowerment is good economics, which I think we'll probably touch on a little later. So then we can give up this holiday.
Like that.
Yeah, well, you come up with a slogan for that.
Yeah, say that again. Women empowerment?
What I said. So, you know.
It was a good line.
Oh, yeah?
I'll have to listen to this playback.
Okay, we'll listen later. So I wanted to just touch on six clear reasons I thought about today why we still need feminism, okay, and why we still want to celebrate while we're making everyone aware, sort of celebrating women and to talk about the problems that still persist even though women have the right to vote and can drive motor vehicles. First of all, rape culture and domestic violence. Okay, I mean, here's a question for Women's History Month. What strikes one American woman in four, one out of four women, and claims a life in the United States every 6 hours? Okay, the answer?
Ding!
Domestic violence. Oh, I had my own one I should have done.
Yeah.
Here, okay. Oh, yeah. Yes, it's domestic violence and sexual assault. Deserves way more attention and resources. Deserves way more police understanding of the complexities involved. You know, I used to, in my early part of the career, I was a public defender in the inner city, and they were constantly, you know, all the issues when the police were called and they go to a home and there's domestic violence. I mean, it's, you know, it is almost always sort of male perpetrator driven. And the police are not, they're not, they have no idea how to deal with these things. If it's difficult, they'll either arrest everybody or they don't want to have to deal with it. It's like that's a personal situation, that's how they treat it. And if they had a little bit more training in it, perhaps some lives would be saved. Way more resources need to be, I mean, as Nicholas Kristof said, I believe in an op-ed piece in the New York Times today or yesterday, it is vast, it is outrageous, and it should be a national priority. Vast, outrageous, and should be a national priority in terms of the damage that's done, the hidden scourge of domestic violence and how it's like, how, and most of us don't, do you and I know someone who is affected by that in our lives?
Yeah.
How many, you know, how many people don't know of some woman in their life that has one way or another been affected by some gender-based antipathy? And if it results in violence, you know, that is a major shame and unfortunate, and didn't have to happen. You know that American women, Deborah, are twice as likely to suffer domestic violence every year as to contract breast cancer? I mean, twice as likely to be a victim of domestic violence.
Wow.
Yeah, twice as likely. And every year, 60 million girls are assaulted on, this is like that would be the global statistic, that every year, 60 million girls are assaulted on their way to school. In some parts of the world, a girl is more likely to be raped than to go to school.
Right.
Violence against women and girls is a global epidemic. And you know what? Where the West is really far from immune. You know, the abuse is particularly shattering because it comes often from those we have loved, you know, or we still love,
right,
or who say they love us. You know, based on victimization surveys, it seems, and there's been some progress. The victimization survey I saw this morning said that violence by men against their intimate partners has fallen by almost two-thirds since 1993. Attitudes have changed. In 1987, only half of Americans said that it was always wrong for a man to beat his wife with a belt or a stick. A decade later, now 86% say it's always wrong to beat your wife with a stick or a belt.
Okay, but that's still 14% that say
beat her with a stick or a belt. Maybe it's a softer belt. Women worldwide, ages 15 to 44, are more likely to die or be maimed as a result of male violence than as a consequence of war, cancer, malaria, and traffic accidents combined.
I mean, wow.
Why are you supposed to? You know, so for more Americans, mostly women, have been killed in the last dozen years at the hands of their partners than in the wars in Iraq and Iran combined. And again, we don't seem to really talk. You don't really hear that.
Why?
On corporate media.
Why don't we hear it? Because it's run by men, controlled by men,
right.
Edited by men.
Right.
I mean, this comes to the whole point of women in media, women in movies, how women in advertising, how they're depicted.
Right.
You know, Gina Davis has that whole women in media.
Right, media.
And for 10 years, I've been following her blog. And actually, they just, this is when I actually brought the article. So this year's Oscars, they analyzed the movies, how much screen time women actually get.
Right.
And Sandra Bullock in Gravity, you know, had far and away, partly because of the story. But generally, the number is men have 85 minutes, actresses have 57 minutes.
Right. And let's not forget, too, that when, I mean, this is almost a separate issue, but it's part of it. You know, women of a certain age, right, are much older than their comparably situated male stars. So when they cast Clint Eastwood with, I think it was in Line of Fire, if that was when he played it. Rene Russo. So he was in his late 70s. She was what? Maybe she was 40. You know, if you look at Sean Connery, you know, women, he's a leading man at 80, you know, 40 years their junior. You'd never see it in the reverse. It would be like
a joke.
It would be like a black comedy of some kind.
Exactly.
So why they can't, right? So, you know, if you're Meryl Streep, they're not casting you and maybe, you know, as in a leading role with a man of her own age. Usually not. So,
anyway,
listen, the fact that we live in a culture that has failed to deter violent sexual crime and has sort of normalized it to the point that people feel it's acceptable to make jokes about it, which people do, it's really unacceptable. One in four, it's too high a statistic. One in four women, it's too high.
You know, and isn't that the statistic for women in college? Like one in four
date rapes
mm-hmm. in college.
Right. I mean, you know, so again, not acceptable for my daughter, not acceptable for your daughter. I would think it's not acceptable for anyone's, you know, child. And I don't know how and why. You know, I know many men be listening to say, if it was my daughter, I'd get out my shotgun and I'd take care of the situation. Well, but what about everybody else's daughter? And it'll be less likely to be your daughter if we made some fundamental changes, which we're not yet making. So let me go on to the second, enough on sexual violence. Now we can move into unequal pay for, you know, equal work, which is, you know, right up our, you know, alley. Women's work is still, it's inexplicable, but still considered to be supplemental to a man. You know, women are still paid, as we said, less than men. It's in Europe, it's 70 cents on every dollar. Apparently here in the United States, still hovering at 77 cents on every dollar that a man earns for the exact same job. On top of that, women are still often pushed into lower paying so-called pink collar careers, as you mentioned earlier, Deborah, which, you know, adds to the income problem. It creates this veritable, what some commentators have called the pink ghetto for many working women, and they can't get out of it.
Yeah.
And according to a new report from the Institute of Women's Policy Research, the pay gap in the United States between men and women increased now between 2011 and 2012, with women making on average $163 less per week than men. $163 less per week than men. Now, on the wage gap between men and women exists even for higher paying jobs as well. So there's no lawyers, doctors, engineers. It's way more than $163 differential per week.
But it's still that same percentage.
It's still the same percentage, and it still exists.
Right.
It's sort of an intractable problem. And women are also more likely to work in minimum wage paying jobs. There's such a large disparity in the wage gap that, listen to this number, the woman's total lifetime earnings loss to the wage gap could feed a family of four for 37 years.
Yeah.
Okay? I mean, that's not, you know, chicken feed. It's not $163. It's, again, it's everything. Again, men would kill to make that not happen.
Right.
And this increase in the wage gap is despite the signing of the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act in 2009.
Or which, the Kennedy's Equal Pay.
Right. Well, the original Equal Pay Act, it was, you know, the Equal Pay Act of 1963, which John, as Deborah said, John Kennedy signed into law, which is supposed to make gender-based differential earnings illegal. There's so many problems with it, though. And in fact, Lilly Ledbetter, it's quite, we should get, maybe we can get Lilly Ledbetter on our show. Lilly Ledbetter worked at the Goodrich Tire Factory in Texas or somewhere down south for many, many, many years and was earning 40% less than the lowest paid man. And she sued, and she was outrageously sexually harassed to boot and was there for years. And when she finally went to trial, I mean, years of having to fight her own employer to be paid what she's worth. She won several million dollars at trial, and it went all the way up the appellate, you know, chain, where it was reversed on appeal, and then it reversed and affirmed. The reversal was affirmed by the highest court, the United States Supreme Court, that said in a 5-4 decision that it's okay that she was paid much less, because here's the problem. The Equal Pay Act said that you have to complain about your paycheck being unequal within 180 days of it happening. It was like 10 years before she even found out she wasn't being paid everything she was supposed to be paid. And that's still the problem with the law, which is why the Paycheck Fairness Act, that the Republicans every single session filibuster and say, sorry, women shouldn't earn as much as men. And, you know, they still get elected. Nobody really talks about how outrageous and scurrilous that scandal is. They say,
wait a minute, explain that.
Okay, that the Paycheck Fairness Act deals with a couple of loopholes, even in the Lilly Ledbetter law, such as the fact that employers don't have to tell you what they pay everybody. They don't like you talking about it. They could fire you for that. They won't tell you what the person sitting next to you is being paid, so you don't have a way to find out. And there are, you know, other issues, again, with statutes of limitations still under the old law that was just refashioned under the Lilly Ledbetter Act. The Paycheck Fairness Act takes care of that and makes the salaries of comparable situated employees available. So you can find out. They have to post what everybody earns. So you can see it in black and white. Jimmy, how come he's making three times what I'm making?
An employer has to post this?
It. Make it available. I don't know. That has to be
okay,
in the cafeteria.
Okay, so make it available. So if I worked for bank
Right. So you are a teller at a bank, and you say, wait a minute, I have a feeling that I'm an assistant manager, I'm an assistant day manager. I have another assistant day manager on my days off is Jimmy. I don't think Jimmy's making the kind of crummy salary I'm making. You'd be able to find out. And if there's there are exceptions. There are ways that you could be paid more. The fact that you're a man or a woman, a man could be paid more if he has the experience, if he has the education, if he has merit. There are a number of, an employer could say, this has nothing to do with your gender. This has to do with Jimmy deserves to make more. But when all of the things are equal, which they often are, you're both working as bank tellers, you're both assistant managers, the only thing different is your DNA, you're a woman, he's a man, you'll find out, and you could say, excuse me, how come I'm making 70 cents on his dollar? They couldn't explain it. It's illegal, period.
They get away with that by making it a range? Isn't that what, assistant bank manager, this pay range is from 40 to 52,000. So as long as you're within that range, could be making 40 and he's making 52.
You're talking about, though, an arbitrary and perhaps whimsical and capricious. If you say...
No, that's why I'm asking.
No, I'm saying, but if the woman looks at it and says, well, I'm making 40, and they say, that's right, 40 is within a discretionary, Jimmy's making 52, it's right up there. And they say...
Oh, I see. So
says,
each person
he
has to be...
He came to work 3 days before me. Why is he making 12,000 more?
Right.
Why?
Yeah.
If it's not, you say, well, I believe it's because he has male genitalia. I mean, that's why he's a boy. And you could say, and I've heard these myself as an employment lawyer, when they say, well, come on, I mean, he's got 2.5 kids in the suburbs, he's paying a mortgage, he's got a wife, you know, so-and-so is a single woman, come on, you know. And it's like, hello. And you know what? Some people still think that is true now.
Family pay.
Let alone, family, well, and also never mind that most of our single parents are women in this country, they're the ones that have families and have to deal with paying bills and contributing and paying taxes, so hopefully our economy would grow. It's not growing when they're being paid, you know, bupkis. So we have a lot of work to do when it comes to ensuring women have equal rights and equal power in our country. And it's, you know, it's work we all need to do because men alone are not all that good for the world, you know. Testosterone's terrible drug. Mm-hmm. And if it's not tempered, it's that yin and the yang, and we don't really have much of the sort of yang going on. You know, we need both of us. And as women get on equal footing with men, all society prospers, in my opinion. You know, for example, if a female participation in the workforce increased, it would do wonders for our current dwindling economy.
Right.
You know, according to a recent study, I believe this was by a company called Booz and Company, if the female employment rate in the U.S. simply matched male rates, the nation's overall gross domestic product would rise by 5%.
Companies that have women in their corporate hierarchy, mm-hmm. on the board, running companies, or in substantive positions, are far more profitable and successful
exactly.
than companies without. I'm telling you, I just was doing all this research on this blog. I just forgot all this stuff.
Right. Well, you might have read what I wrote down. I wrote it down, and then you read it.
Because corporations
that are now persons under the under the Supreme Court's outrageous decision a few years ago, corporations would benefit from empowered women. One of the biggest problems with women in the workforce today is they aren't getting top positions in companies.
Right.
So, in fact, 36% of U.S. companies currently don't have even one single woman on their board of directors. And various studies have suggested that gender-mixed leadership boosts companies' profits, which really shouldn't be a surprise to any of us. One study of similarly sized businesses showed that those with women on their boards actually outperformed those with only men. That's what you may be referring to.
Yeah, we read the same thing.
So listen, you know, the average pay disparity, as I mentioned, was 77 cents on the dollar and adds up to $163 less for each average woman than the average man earns each week, is bad news for all of us, considering that, you know, women are increasingly the primary breadwinners in their families. That,
mm-hmm.
That's what I was mentioning. Increasingly, you know, women are the ones with the single parents are almost exclusively women in our culture still. And as such, their pay becomes vital for survival. Less pay means that their survival and their kids' survival is in jeopardy. If the kids aren't getting education,
lower
the kids are going to prison.
Well,
we're paying for all this stuff. Right. And there's less of a tax base. It's all about, you know, revenue, which we're not getting from the wealthy.
And you'd think the job creators would be looking at that.
Well, they're not the job creators. That's the point. That's what they call themselves, but they're not. And you would think, though, they would care. Why do you want to be a rich person in a poor country? I don't get that. So, you know what? Speaking of that, economists have suggested, I know Paul Krugman has suggested, that closing the gender pay gap would be the equivalent of a giant economic stimulus, bigger than the sort of half-baked one we had that almost helped us get out of the recession. It would grow the U.S. economy by 3 to 4 percentage points if we simply closed the gender pay gap.
Yes. I also read it would be the fifth largest GDP.
What, on the world?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. To what it is now,
which I don't know, but
it would get better.
It would get much better.
Okay, let's talk about attacks on pro-choice policies, which is also part of it. Pro-choice policies are necessary for keeping abortions safe, because when abortion is outlawed, the practice of aborting unwanted children doesn't go away. It just goes underground, where it's more dangerous and it's more likely to result in serious complications after the fact. So, you know, listen, abortion is legal in the United States. We were adults, right? When 1973, when abortion became illegal, the fact that there are still attempts by our states, to limit access to abortion is a serious issue when it comes to allowing women to make their own health decisions. As I mentioned earlier, I believe that one of two or three in the entire state of Texas
is
closed down.
Yeah.
And it's closing down not because of lack of business. It's closing down because lawmakers, male Republican lawmakers, are making it impossible for them to function. And for all different kinds, they have to be near a hospital, they have to be a resident of the hospital, have admitting privileges within 10 miles or whatever it is. Meanwhile, it's not hurting the doctor, it's hurting those women that he serves. It's just really outrageous. And you know, it's tied into that, attacks on birth control. You know, there's something like, and I didn't know this, 6 to 9 million women in the U.S. use birth control for non-contraceptive reasons. So when, for instance, Republican lawmakers try, and sometimes successfully, to restrict access to birth control, to say that your insurance shouldn't pay for it, they're interfering with the health of women for no reason.
Right.
For no, absolutely no reason. And on top of that, Viagra is still covered by insurance, often. There's no reason why birth control shouldn't be, aside from the societal double standard that determines what's acceptable for men and what's acceptable for women.
Right.
A man can have his play drug and say, oh, I have erectile dysfunction. He's using it for fun.
Mm-hmm.
And birth control that has many other reasons, health reasons, beside simply making sure, which is an important reason, that one doesn't have an unwanted pregnancy, that is completely, you know, that in the name of religious freedom, we can't have women, you know, take care of themselves in that way. And regardless of reason why a woman is on birth control, it's her health. It's her decision. So proponents of smaller government should maybe take their message to heart and stop micromanaging the health decisions of others. What do you think?
Well, I completely agree. I completely agree. It's mind-boggling. You know, when you listen to people who are opposed to abortion, you know, life, killing, murder, you know, they frame it in all of that.
Right.
Yet, and so, and I can respect that as a belief, as a value. But for me, I may be opposed to ever having an abortion or wanting one, but it is someone else's choice. But you would think that the people who oppose abortion would be pro-family,
right,
and pro, let's take care of these kids,
right,
and let's get them educated, and let's not have them hungry.
Right.
And, you know, so if there is an unwanted pregnancy, that these women and children are taken care of, but their policies counter that.
Well,
so
right.
I can't buy into it.
Well, because it's an empty suit. This emperor has no clothes.
And again, it's mostly men, whether it be, you know, local, state, or federal, who are in charge, who don't get pregnant, who don't have accidental pregnancies,
right,
who don't find themselves in these positions, who can point their fingers and make the laws.
But it's outrageous and sociopathic by definition, just that you would take a position where pro-life, Jesus, life, love, oh, it's all life is sacred, until, as the sort of the joke goes, until the baby comes out of the womb, and then you're on your own. No Head Start. No
right.
education,
exactly.
No food stamps, no women's infants and children funding for
daycare,
nutrition
so that the women can work.
Right. So they could care less. It's just a cruel ruse, just a joke, and it's really it's awful. And here's something though, another point. You know, as we're talking about Women's History Month and celebrating women's issues, or talking about what still needs to be done, is the devaluation of motherhood that we see in our work all the time. The fact that in a country where motherhood is considered so sacred, that politicians are willing to step on women's rights concerning their own bodies in order to force motherhood upon them,
mm-hmm.
what we just were talking about. But we don't walk the talk in any way, because if you all you have to do is compare maternity leave, which we've discussed before. How do we fare with maternity leave compared to the rest of the world?
Well, I think we're ahead of Uzbekistan.
Uzbekistan. No, I think we're tied for dead last with like Papua New Guinea.
Yeah.
If that's how you pronounce it, and Swaziland.
Swaziland,
which I thought was
178 countries.
Right, and we're pulling up the freaking rear. We're way in the back. And by the way, most of the other countries you could think about in Europe, Canada, the Netherlands, Scandinavia, everywhere else, basically, and sort of Latin America. Not only is maternity leave, you have an entitlement to have your baby in peace and come back to a job that has security, but they understand you have to feed your child, and they pay you for your maternity leave. Not here, even for the few of us here that are covered by the Family and Medical Leave Act, and it's less than half the workforce. There's no pay involved in it. So it's like we're just full of it.
Right.
Have that baby, you're on your own, sister.
You're
on your own. Hope you have a trust fund. So, you know,
and that's where the Affordable Care Act will begin to help women, because women having a baby end up often taking on profound debt.
Right.
And
right.
And with a minimum wage job or a lower paid lower paying job, they can't get out from underneath that.
Right.
And then when you add they don't get paid while they're out, and the costs of babies and health care and all that other stuff.
They have health insurance, so at least there's a possibility of being able to be covered under. We should have Medicare Part E, which is for everybody, which FDR proposed. I mean, again, that's the other issue, that we're dead last in. We're the only civilized nation in the world that doesn't consider health care a right of citizenship. I mean, it's a job should be a right of citizenship. But, you know, what America doesn't consider, Deb, doesn't consider motherhood to be real work, because that's really the point. Right. I mean, in fact, our politicians have said so. So if it doesn't respect how difficult it is for working mothers, instead they're often vilified for being less attentive to their children, while the stay-at-home mothers are portrayed as not really working.
Right.
So, you know, and again, so they're the ones that are fortunate enough to be married to, you know, a venture capitalist or a hedge fund manager. So this is just another fantastic contradiction that creates this lose-lose situation for women in the United States. And finally, I was saying I'd mentioned 6 points today that we should talk about with regard to work that still needs to be done. How about lack of women in leadership positions? You know, Rwanda
beats us.
It beats us. Best male-to-female ratio kills us with male-to-female ratio in terms of their political leaders. You'd think it might be time for the Western world to shape up a little bit.
Right.
You know, women.
That was really eye-opening.
Rwanda
is beating
us. Right. They're eating our lunch.
You know,
when it comes to, you know, promoting women's issues, because when women are in leadership, they tend to vote for the hearth and home, and sort of to take care of the more vulnerable. For, I think you called it the safety net issues earlier, but right now we have women currently holding only 17% of the seats in Congress. And only 22% in statewide elected executive seats are held by women. So, again, you have 53% of the population female, 17% of seats in Congress, 6 female governors right now out of, you know, 50. According to the WCF Foundation, 50% less women than men, 50% less women than men even consider running for office, and of those, only 30% actually and getting the ability, the wherewithal to actually run. And female politicians raise less money for campaigns than their male counterparts, with all the things equal. They just can't raise the money in a world right now that requires unending fundraising in order to stay in the game, because we don't have what we need, publicly funded elections. And it puts women at a huge disadvantage. And even outside the electoral system, women are faltering in gaining prominence. You know, what if we encourage more women to be involved with politics, right? I mean, because right now, if women make up just on average 20% of lawmakers in the United States and abroad, when women aren't outnumbered by men in political office like they are in Washington, they tend to speak up more about issues affecting most of us.
Right.
And the poor and the vulnerable, but also protecting the social safety net, which again, Tea Party nonsense aside, we all, it's like the Tea Party people say, you know, it's not about, I don't want a redistribution of wealth, but keep your hands off my Medicare.
Right.
Right? And keep your hands off my Social Security. Hello. This is what, we really want to go back to what it was like, you know, before the New Deal, before the Great Society, when basically old age perhaps meant, you know, impoverishment and lack of dignity and sort of dying in the street. I don't think we do. And you know, research shows a strong correlation between the number of female elected officials in government and less corruption of power. Maybe that's what they need, a little bit more women in New Jersey.
Right. Well, and not only that, but there was another study done that women tend to be more effective in terms of reaching consensus.
Mm-hmm,
you know, in the last shutdown, it was the 5 female senators that got together and came up with a bill that solved the whole thing.
Right. And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it goes back to our DNA. Women were in the cave,
okay.
You know, sitting there with children. You know, how are we going to get along while we're sitting in this cave waiting for him to come back with the mastodon so we can all eat?
Right.
And there's a sense of community and compassion.
Right. Well, the same research showed a positive effect on government in general when women break into the so-called old boys club. It sort of breaks that hard shell of.
Right, and men can be a part of that because there is something to women being invited to run.
Mm-hmm.
So men tend to ask other men, why don't you run?
Right, right.
As opposed to they could easily ask, invite, endorse, mentor, promote women.
Right. Well, but, you know, they're girls.
And then that's why women and minorities end up in the same sort of boat. A white man is less likely to invite a woman, a black woman, forget
mm-hmm.
about
mm-hmm.
it.
Right. Well, it's that white man.
Or even a Hispanic man.
Right. Well, they're too busy inviting Ted Nugent to
exactly.
president's State of the Union. So, look, we have just about a minute or two left. It's clear. I'll just wrap it up by saying it's obvious, Deborah, that women can do amazing things for our country, you know, boosting our economy to rooting out corruption in government. And, while there's been much debate over the last couple of years around the time of the election and after about female empowerment as it centers around women's health issues, and while a woman's right to make her own health decisions is essential, female empowerment shouldn't stop there. That should be baseline. When women need greater access to quality education, which is another big issue these days, where that is, there's a huge inequality spectrum on who can afford to go to college. It shouldn't be that way. It wasn't that way. It wasn't Thomas Jefferson's vision when he founded the first free university, the mm-hmm. University of Virginia. And,
Virginia is the worst place for a woman to live.
Yeah?
Yeah, in terms of access, laws, rules, voting, women in power, pay.
Pretty red state.
It's, there's a study that analyzed every state, and Virginia's at the bottom, by the
okay.
way.
Well, let's not move there. And, you know, women need an identical opportunity to succeed in workplace, and that's what, you know, as with women's rights in the workplace advocates, we see all the time that and pregnancy is often the sort of the pivot point that changes, that makes diverges women away from the successful trajectory into the mommy track.
Right.
That's a problem. Women have come a long way since the first International Women's Day in 1910. This was a time when even women couldn't even vote. And in some states, they were still legally the property of their husbands. But, you know, now's not the time to say that that's good enough when it comes to female empowerment. Women can help save our culture, our country, and even our planet if we men get out of the way. So for the good of all of us, we should all sort of on a daily basis, it should be every day should be International Women's Day, Deb. That's what
I
it
like
should come
that.
To, right?
I like that.
Then we don't have to have one verstunken a day of the year where we pretend to something like Mother's Day. It's the one day we're going to be nice to you today, and the rest
right.
of the day you're back to business as usual. So,
right.
So from... this is, I believe we have 10 seconds left. So this is Jack Tuckner and Deborah Orell in a Women's Rights in the Workplace Advocate Forum on our Monday 5 p.m. show. Happy, thrilled, honored to be with you. We'll see you next week, 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Stay frosty. Don't give up. And remember, it is most precarious. So keep your head screwed on right. And we'll see you soon.